Y'all, gentlemen, welcome back to season 2 of the Let's Talk About Autism Among Us podcast. This is your host, Tia Yang Lee. I am a board certified behavior analyst, and if you tuned in last season, you'll know we kicked off the podcast with our pilot episode about autism and K-dramas. I then took you through a winding journey between the experiences of Hmong families and Hmong professionals. I wonder which one was your favorite, which ones resonated with you most, and which one did you feel like you learned the most from? Also, which one did you feel like, wow, I never even knew about that before? I'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for a possible season 3. So hold on tight, because season 2 is going to be even more jam-packed with information and stories from Hmong individuals, family members, and professionals who are so amazing in helping me to continue to normalize the conversation about autism in Hmonglish. Welcome back. I knew I wanted to open up season 2 with a big bang and answer the much-asked question of what is autism in Hmong? I needed the voice and the expertise of a diagnosing clinician who sends the referrals on over to me so that I can then do my part in the autism service provider lineup. I'm so humbled and grateful to have Dr. Alyssa Kaying Vang from the Twin Cities join me on this episode. I had hoped she would share her insights on autism and mental health, given her vast background and understanding of the Hmong culture. But what I didn't expect was to have even more questions now that the recording is over. Listen on and share with me your feedback on my thought-provoking chat with Dr. Vang. Hello and welcome to, I can't believe I'm saying this, but season 2 of the Let's Talk About Autism in Hmonglish podcast. I am so excited to even be able to say that. I wasn't sure if it was going to happen because after season 1, I thought, I feel like I covered most of the things, but then I had a lot of listeners send in suggestions and I thought, can we tackle those topics? Are we ready for that? And the more I got to talking with those listeners, I realized, yes, we have to tackle these topics, you know. And so as I was designing season 2, my husband, he's kind of my marketing person. He's been helping me just to get a grasp on the Hmong approach to mental health, to autism, and who already is out there in this arena, not just the mental health arena, but the Hmong mental health arena. And he said, have you heard of Dr. Alyssa Vang? And I said, you know, I feel like I have. I've seen, you know, on social media, but I don't know her. He said, well, here's her email. And I thought, I can't just email her. Like, just, you never know. You know, worst case scenario, she doesn't ever reply. And I thought, okay, that is true. As a new business owner, as a entrepreneur, as a person new to this, I was like, you know what, if they don't reply, it's okay, you know, just we'll figure something out. And so I did, and it was just a general email address, and imagine my shock when I got a reply from the Dr. Alyssa Vang. And I thought, oh, it's not just a bot, okay, it's a person. So you guys, I'm so humbled and honored today to welcome to my little podcast Dr. Alyssa Kaying Vang. Welcome on, doctor.
Thank you so much, Tia, for having me on. And I just get so inspired by younger Hmong Americans, especially younger Hmong American women who are doing their thing, especially doing their thing in the mental health field. And so thank you for reaching out. And if, you know, I see the email, I always respond back, because I'm always so excited when I hear about individuals like yourself who's doing great work in your respective areas. So glad to be here today.
Thank you. And, you know, I was looking for your bio and it said you've been in the field for 20 years. And so could you share with me and my listeners, I guess, what brought you to the field of clinical psychology and go, so this is Hmonglish, so please feel free anytime to interject Hmong, English, in Hmonglish. Did being a Hmong woman kind of influence your decision to go into clinical psychology and how you could help the Hmong community?
Yeah, I'm going to date myself a little bit here, but back in the days when we were going through high school, the goal at that time, the messaging that was sent down from our elders, our parents, mm-hmm. our aunts and uncles were get married after, a certain age because mm-hmm. you want to be an old maid. Yes. And then the other messaging was, you know, if you're going to go to school, study something that's more practical.
Oh, yes.
And so I listened to one of them. I didn't get married, so I didn't listen to that. But I thought that I would go to school for business. Mm-hmm. And, I don't have to get into the details of that, but certainly my father really felt that that would be a challenge because business. But I went into that field anyway. But during college, I sort of found myself, and I think that's what's cool about college is that it allows you to explore without the confines of your Hmong parameters.
Yes.
And so I was able to take different courses. And through that, I discovered that I didn't enjoy the business and the accounting classes so much, but I enjoyed more so the social science classes, you know, especially psychology and the study mm-hmm. of human behaviors and psychopathology and all of that. And then it just really led me to reflect on my own life. And all along, I had always had a keen interest in human behaviors.
Yes.
But not always cognizant of it. And college was where the pieces just kind of fell into place, and psychology courses were just easy and fun. Yeah. And why go into a field that's hard and not fun, right? And right. So that's how I stumbled into this field. And then, you know, further down the road, I realized, oh, I was exposed to it earlier on as an interpreter for my mom.
Okay.
And again, these things don't reveal themselves to you as you're navigating life as a kid, as a teenager, as a young adult. But that's how I fell into psychology, and I just loved it. And I knew that I wanted to do direct psychotherapy because I mm-hmm. enjoyed the listening piece of it. I'm much more of an introvert, and I say less. And I mean, right now I talk a lot more than most people. But at the beginning, I had less to say and more to just listen and reflect. And I just fell into, this space where I knew I didn't want to be a researcher. I wanted to be a direct provider.
Yes.
And at a bachelor's level, you can't do therapy. You right. just do a lot of case management. You do a lot of group homes. And at least that was what was available back then. So it just, you know, it just was the natural next step was to go to college and get a degree so that I could do what I had always felt I loved doing.
Yes. And so was that in California? Is that correct? Were you?
Yes. Yes. So I was out in California and did my undergrad there at the University of California in Santa Barbara, and then took a year or two off, I can't remember, and then went back to graduate school, got my master's and my doctorate in psychology, in clinical psychology out in the Central Valley, and then was fortunate enough to get my internship here in the Twin Cities.
Okay.
At Hennepin County Medical Center, or now known as Hennepin Healthcare. And, I think it's been quite a blessing to be here in the Twin Cities, to be able to provide support for the community here, not only the Hmong community, but the other BIPOC communities and immigrant and refugee communities, and also
yes.
the dominant community as well, too. So that's yes. great.
That was my next question. Like, what brought you to the Twin Cities?
So the way that college or graduate school works for psychologists is very similar to medical
okay.
schools, where there is your final year where you apply for an internship. So very similar mm-hmm. to residency, and you apply nationally. So you're not restricted to where you are. It's a national application process. And I knew in my heart that there was a lack of Hmong providers. And I knew that there were many Hmong family members and community members who struggled with the mental health challenges related to perhaps the traumatic experiences of the Vietnam War, the traumatic plight out of Laos, just the readjustment, the language barriers and all of that. So I knew that mental health was a pretty significant but underserved or maybe under-identified areas. And so that's what I wanted to do. And so I applied to places that I knew there were pockets of Hmong.
Okay.
And certainly I applied to places in California and then Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Denver, of all places, because my sister lived in Denver at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up here because it's always the meeting and the feel for the training program, meeting the people. And I knew that there was a large Hmong community here, but that wasn't the most important thing. It was, where do I fit in? Where can I get the best training? Because the training after that, you don't get any other training. You're just in the hospital. So I've been very blessed. My journey has been a very blessed one.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I know you said you've been in the field for many, many years, and you've worked with that pocket of Hmong families. Now, we are talking about autism. And so for me, as a BCBA at a master's level, I cannot diagnose. I can sit on a diagnostic team, right, and give my behavioral analytic contribution to the big conversation leading to the diagnosis. But for you, going out through the PhD level clinician there that could give a diagnosis, whether it's in your private practice or on a team. So with that background, then can you tell me what is the overall sentiment from Hmong families who present with a child who is or maybe on the autism spectrum? Because I don't know if you, I think on your website, you do cover, the ADHD, autism. So maybe the Hmong family, will refer to you by their pediatrician. And luckily, in the Twin Cities, they are directed to need to go to see a diagnosing practitioner, and your name is on the roster. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, then are you the Hmong doctor that can help us? So what is the general reception that you get from them when they show up? Is it any different than our white counterparts or other BIPOC communities or just tell me about that experience.
Yeah, I think it really depends on the phase or the stage in which the parents are in at the point of referral.
Yes.
Because it's mixed. And just to clarify, our clinic no longer does testing for autism. And, and I know it's a full battery. You go through and you administer a lot of different tests, whether it's for assessing for cognitive functioning, academic functioning, or the ADOS, which is often used to diagnose individuals with autism. We have moved away from that just because the needs for direct therapy or psychotherapy are high. And so we don't do that at our clinic. But back in the days when I was still doing that and I was getting referrals, if I was getting parents who were identified, whose child was identified at an earlier stage, when they came in, a lot of it is providing support for the parents. A lot of it is trying to listen to them and hear their concerns. And most of the time, their concerns are related to either physical health or academic functioning. And so when they say that, then I spend a lot of time really trying to understand how they feel about this.
Right.
And oftentimes it is very hard for parents to accept that. But what makes it a lot easier is talking about and talking around how talking around their concerns with the academic right?
Okay.
你要跟到知道，也跟到抽，也跟到你多嘢。 So I find that that's easier for parents to be receptive of. And if I couch the conversation that way, then there's less focus on the stigma of it.
Okay.
And more focus on supporting the child to get to where the parents would want them to be. Now, sometimes parents come in and they're not as invested because maybe they're still struggling with the shame, the guilt, the self-blame, all of those emotions, because whatever it is, curse or whatever, right? So they always believe that there's something that we might have done to result in this kind of challenge. And so I think some of them, if you can avoid it, you don't want to enter into those really difficult conversations. And so I often focus on what their concerns are, what the needs are, and what we can do to get them to that place. Now, there are some parents, when they come in, they're referred, they've already exhausted all the other areas that they're a little bit more open to. And I'm sort of the last resort. So when they come in, they might still be, struggling with some of the emotional things that they're going through, but they're ready to have a conversation about focusing on the child alone. So it's mixed sentiments. But I will say that the biggest challenge is that bechimolu tata. And so I will tell you that as a Hmong person, there are times when the autism diagnosis is missed.
Mm-hmm.
Because the parents are more focused on language delays and cognitive delays.
Yes.
And so when they're more focused on that and there's not a lot of expectations from the child, we don't see the nuanced behaviors that would suggest autism. We just see more of an intellectual impairment.
Right,
an intellectual disability. So many of the kids that come through, we often end up diagnosing them with a intellectual disability and not autism.
Okay, so this is probably where I get into trouble, Dr. Alyssa, because probably because I'm so green that I'm still curious to ask the questions that maybe I should not ask. If we could go back to when you said, despite all of the Hmong beliefs that you know they carry in with them when they arrive to you, but you know, as a clinician, as a licensed clinician, you want to respect their boundaries and you want to be sure that you are just staying within the reins of what you do, but you know in your mind and in your heart, you're like, if they share it, right? You said you don't address it. You kind of bypass it and get to the education part if that's where they're comfortable. So let's tackle that a little bit. Could you talk about that? Like with them, maybe, is there ever a place where there is a conversation to have about that and say, tell anybody or that this happened? It could, because, I am very scientific minded and I know I've seen the research. I live it out every day in practice. But it's so, they hold on to it so firmly, so true. Like, this is it, because somebody highly knowledge, someone that I respect and I revere them because they are a leader in the Hmong customs. And I believe that. And then And then sometimes that can be a barrier to accepting other forms of support and services. And so how do we mitigate that? How do we share a message that says, you know, sure, that can be your belief, but on the other hand, we also have to, do we need to dispel those beliefs and say, I mean, you know, it's such a generational thing. I think that with my generation, I'm all over the place because I have so many questions. When you have families come in, and you know, you don't have to give me a clear number, but like, is it like younger families, younger Hmong parents, older Hmong parents, a mix that you get the same sentiment from, or is it different based on their age group? Because I would say maybe Gyalhom and Gina, and they're less inclined to walk in with such a conviction of, oh, versus they might be less inclined to say that versus an older couple comes in and they're just like, nope, shaman said this is it, and but we like you said, you're our last resort, here we are. So tell me about that. Like, can we address it? Can we have a conversation about it? Like, is it how do, because I feel like we need to address it in order to move forward, you know, in order for me to have this conversation in the Hmong community. I feel like we have to address it and say, you guys, don't let that be a barrier, you know, like still have your convictions, but also know that science can help.
Right. Well, I think to answer your most recent question, it's, we have a mix, and it's not in terms of their beliefs, you know, it's not because of generations, it's not because of age, it's not because of acculturation. It's a mixed blend. And it's always hard to know at the first meeting until you dive into a deeper conversation.
Right.
Because someone can be really young, but still be very traditional in their beliefs. Someone can be a Christian, but still have these beliefs at the heart of how they navigate life. And it's, you know, in terms of spirituality being such a huge component of the way that we look at the world, the way that we navigate different health and healing approaches. It's just that a very powerful influence in the way that in the way that we live our life, in the blessings that we receive, and in the health that you know we have right currently, like how healthy we are. So I think it's hard to understand that, and I do think that even though there's a certain generation, certain age groups that are a little bit more scientific based, that they still exist within systems that believe the spirituality piece of it, and that believe in the Eastern psychology piece of it. Right.
Yes.
So then to go back and touch on the other point that you made earlier, I think as a Hmong person, we think holistically because we exist within family and our cultural practices, and the way that we navigate life has always been more collective and holistic.
Yes.
And so I was doing holistic therapy even before I named it holistic therapy. And so when a Hmong family comes in with a child who might have certain delays that are suggestive of autism, I treat them as a whole, in that if I find that the conversation has gone in the direction of I do address it, but I address it from a holistic perspective. Especially if they're not at a place where I have to support and provide psychoeducation on autism, I often say, Oh, chia mong chua tên tờ về để bé mong gì với em mong giờ bé thả vào tên nó giờ bé cô mua cho cái chân tờ thì nay bắt đầu chia lìa cái ba rồi nay chấm nhọ. So it kind of starts that way, and if they say, oh yeah, we tried this and this and this, and I would, you know, it would pique my interest, and I would ask, well, what did the shaman say? What did the spiritual healer say? You know, what have you done? Has it worked? Has it not worked? And usually in that course of conversation, I find that the parents, again, they've ended up in my office because those things may not have worked.
Right.
Or they're wanting more support, or they're now open to more of a holistic approach. Mm-hmm. And so I don't negate what they're doing. I do validate the holistic alternative approaches.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't work, then it gives me, you know, an opportunity to provide information about what my service can do for their child, mm-hmm. how it can be helpful, how it's complementary from a holistic perspective to what they're doing, and how it's not, again, invalidating what they're doing. And so I find that most parents are very open to that, because we're all on this life journey, and we all have very similar goals, which is we want healthy, thriving children.
Yes.
And if we can start there, I think anything is possible.
Yes, absolutely. This is why you're so good at what you do. Because, you know, I'm over here. I get really emotional when I talk about all of these aspects, because I'm still trying to figure out, you know, how do we encourage them to be brave and to even when they go to the table with all of these, I think all of these thought process that, you know, have been instilled and passed on, and that's all they know. But they also know that, yeah, Gahaina, it didn't work, right? It didn't help whatever ritual that was performed. And so now they have to let their guard down and go, okay, now I have to go to, and luckily, Jikana, they're like, oh, it's a Hmong person. There's a level of comfort there. I can imagine what it's like for the Hmong families who don't have that luxury to go to a Hmong clinician and have these conversations. So thank you for all that you've done to help the Hmong families, because it is a daunting journey, y'all, to receive. Like you said, usually it is when and then so at that point, their child's like five. So for 5 years, they've kind of just accepted and just thought, oh, you know, we'll just wait and see what schools tell us. And then it's a little bit of a shock, you know, if nobody mentioned it to them before, the word autism. And so that kind of segues into my next question, Dr. Alyssa. Autism. So many professionals reach out to me, and families reach out because they want to understand so that they can help educate their family members. Mm-hmm. What is autism? Yeah, I've been promoting this episode going, we're going to talk about what is autism? What is autism? That's a big buzz question, because I think we want to understand beyond La Luna, and people ask, are we going to recoin it? Are we going to give it a name? You know, so there in the Twin Cities, I think that the Somali community is big, and I've heard and seen that they kind of coined a term for autism. And I like it, that the way that they did it, it makes sense for me. But in the Hmong community, I don't know, as a clinician, I'm not sure that it's necessary for us, because mm-hmm. I think what we should focus on is figuring out as a collective, how do we describe it in a way? Because, yeah, kahina, the parents are concerned about the physical attributes, or, you know, if there are any needs for, like, occupational therapy, right? Like the stemming, or the tiptoe walking, or the academic perspective. But they are, you know, they fail to acknowledge that there's the cognitive or the behavioral components of it. And so, you know, sure, we could come up with a term, but we still need to define in Hmong very well what the characteristics are. Because you got the, but that's also not true, because it's a spectrum. There are some individuals with autism, right? So it's so difficult to say, this is what autism looks like, because it's so different. You can, the spectrum is so broad. You know, there's, you're very, you know, the Asperger side, like the very savants, and you know they can rattle off. They're the little professors, and then you have Doi, Yingqi Hailu. You know, it may engage in self injury. You know, so it's very difficult to explain to a multiple person this is autism. So can you shed some light on that with me and how you would explain that? Hello, listeners. If you are hearing this ad, thank you so very much for taking the time to give my little podcast some love and attention. I hope that you will share your favorite episodes with your family and friends and that they also do the same. I know there are some Hmong families out there who don't know about this safe space I've created where you can hear the stories of Hmong families and Hmong professionals talking about their experiences with autism. This podcast is produced by Thea Yali Consulting, LLC. I am Thea, and I wanted to take a minute to invite you to check out another passion project of mine that was recently launched. I created an online course entitled The Lifespan of Parenting Your Child with Autism for any and all parents who have a child with a disability. The online course is spoken in Hmonglish with English subtitles so that all parents can access this information that I share about your 18-month-old all the way to old age. This course is designed to empower you to become your child's best advocate with me as your guide. As a bonus and special thank you for hearing this ad on the Let's Talk About Autism in Hmonglish podcast, DM me and I'll send you a 30% off coupon. Talk soon!
Yeah, and I think that's why diagnosing kids with autism, as I referenced earlier, is very challenging in the Hmong community. Mm-hmm. Because number one, parents are not attuned to some of these nuanced quirks, if I may call them, delays or challenges that would kind of, you know, turn the light bulb for us as clinicians to say, okay, there you go. That's a trait of autism. In fact, I had a child that I worked with for a whole year before I thought, I think this child is autistic. Mm-hmm. Because this child was on the higher end of the autistic, spectrum. Mm-hmm. And parents, most Hmong parents are so busy with trying to be financially secure so that they can provide the basic needs for their family that they're not always attuned to some of the nuances of sensory issues.
Right.
The nuances of food texture sensory or noise level sensory or you know the behaviors of lining toys or repetitive behaviors. They just see that the miona hachipohailu nu jijongi they law ni jijongi they yao they law they yao they surpass new love. They just know it in more of a global delay, right?
Right.
And that also speaks to Bei Hmong, we have a very dichotomous mindset about strengths and deficits. It's either a new duola nun j, right? It's either new momola nu ji momo.
Yeah.
Right. There's no spectrum. There's no in between. And and so it gets really hard as clinicians to try to dig into those because parents will say, because they're not paying attention to it. But what I found is that even for parents who are very savvy, who come in and they already understand that their child has autism, for all of these reasons, right, for all the symptoms that I will say in a few minutes. But what I found with those parents is that they just use the word autism. Okay, that captures the essence of the child and the challenges that the child is going through and the challenges that the family is going through. And then it automatically just helps you to develop a treatment plan that captures the whole individual of that child. Because I think, and to speak to the word autism in the Somali community, I know there's a higher percentage of kiddos that are diagnosed with autism in their community. And I wonder a lot about cultural practices and how it might show up too, but and why they're diagnosed more than other communities. But I think for Bei Hmong, na mai hai ilo lo na ye ni chi capture that, ho pe ya lo chi chua Moje. Sometimes it's, like you said, Tia, sometimes it's better to just leave that word alone and mm-hmm. just use that word. I often think of words like apple, the fruit, mm-hmm. right? You, your hai lo lu, your chi lo lu, chia lo. Everybody uses apple. We all understand it, right? Oh, yeah, you, and the, you know, even the words like iPad. And you're like, oh, is it an iPhone? Is it an iPad? Is it, right? And iPad, okay, we know. And we mm-hmm. don't have to use another word, right? And so I think that for me, and I don't particularly specialize in working with the autistic community, but for me, using that word with families who bring their child in who is living with autism, that seems to just, again, be easier for us. And then we can yes. move on to the more important things, right?
Yes.
But in terms of symptoms, of course, we know that, you know, individuals with autism show developmental disabilities in two areas, and they have difficulties in two areas, which is the social communication and interactions,
yes.
and then the restrictive repetitive behaviors or yes. interests. Those are the two hallmark behavioral challenges. Certainly there could be speech delays, which is one of the first thing that we think about with mm-hmm. young toes, right? Are they meeting their milestones developmentally speaking? If they're not speaking when they're supposed to, if they're not responding when they're supposed to, if they're not making eye contact as a baby, my baby played, you know, peekaboo, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when we play peekaboo with the blankets, if they're not responding, their facial expressions are restricted, then we often wonder what's going on. And of course, we rule out all the other medical concerns first. Can they see? Can they hear?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And once we rule all that out, then we go to, are there any delays developmentally? And I know right now the word is neurodivergent.
Yes.
Are there any neurodivergent you know, concerns with this individual. But be mona be jo de nu ngoli nu nu ke ke ni chi koli, right? Ya ngoli ni chi hai lua ka no yo to la chi to. The hola lu na be I you know, we use it not because we agree with it, we use it because it captures the way in which we describe it. And it's not necessarily a good word.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it's, we have to be real. That's what parents use, right?
Yes.
So
we'll come back to that later.
yeah.
On that word.
Okay. And so when our child is not developing as we would want them to, then we tend to go with the delays of the cognition. And yet the biggest piece is the social communication,
yes.
the social interactions, and the repetitive play and the repetitive interest. And I think that's where mm-hmm. because they have mm-hmm. you know, these really focused interests.
Yes.
They know all the names of the presidents at age 3.
Yeah.
Right? Then you're like, yes. oh, so mm-hmm. why do you have concerns about my child?
Right.
Because we have more of a, what's the word? I can't think of the word, but we believe that all things will happen if it's meant to happen.
Yes.
We're less of, let's take control of the situation. Let's intervene early. Let's do this. We're more of leaving it to fate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so we have this acceptance of just things that happen to us. This is, you know, my fate. Therefore, I must accept it because mm-hmm.
Yes.
We just have to accept that. And for you young generations, you're like, no, you can change that. Don't just accept it, change it. But because that's sort of our mindset, when then we don't seek any services for it because we see the strengths which the child has and we have hope that the child will lead a normal life. But what we know is that kids with autism, if they don't get the early intervention services, mm-hmm. they're going to struggle as they get older.
Yes.
They're going to struggle socially because having very restricted interests will make them look different. Mm-hmm. And especially at the middle school age, no one wants to hang around with someone who doesn't have good social skills.
Right.
And can be very smart, but is awkward socially. Mm-hmm. Then they start to drop off the social scene. And yeah. then as an adult, they're living a very isolated life.
Yes.
Right. And we don't think about that, but that's what most autistic kids are facing. Right. They can be very highly intelligent because they're on the higher functioning level, but they're not going to be living a life that can be full if they yes. don't have services in those areas, and especially those areas of social communication and interactions.
Absolutely. I mean, you hit the nail on the head on every level, and you're preaching to the choir right now. And I'm like, yes, yes, yes. You know, I think a lot of it also goes to what does the Hmong people as a collective whole value? Y'all, we talk about the very few words that we have. And so, you know, my husband's a little bit of a linguist, and he shared with me there's a small ethnic group in like the northern hemisphere where ice is very important to them. Like without ice, there's no survival, you know? And so they have like maybe 5 to 10 terms just mm-hmm. for ice alone. So like you said, apple, so we just adopt apple, we all know. And so if you think about, it's just interesting. And of course, you know, I'm sure you already know this, but it occurred to me, and it really was such a great example. He said, but did you ever consider that in the Hmong language, Jimmo Ilalu to equate no? There isn't, right? Dr. Alyssa, kapa nuna kapa kongfudakutha. You cannot just say the one word that equates no. It would be such a roundabout way of saying it. Oh, tia, kuchimo shiha, kutochita. That's not no, right? That's like a lot of words encompass an idea. So there isn't one word for no, because in our Hmong community, we don't know how to say the word no, right? No, it's not important. We don't, we actually, you know, we kind of stay away from saying no, because we always say yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You know, and so, oh, right. Yes. But there isn't a word. Yes, there isn't a word for no. And so, you know, there's so many things about our language that kind of guide us there. And so, you know, it's just so interesting when people ask me, well, can we come up with a word? I'm like, no, guys, let's just stick with autism. Yeah, go ahead. You know, it's that buzzword. Okay. Now it's up to us to kind of guide the conversation to what does that mean? What does that look like? And you're right. You know, a lot of families, they might think, he said the quirks. It is cute, right? Because you're like, oh, wow, he knows all the presidents. And they were reading at one. And then they're so smart. And yes, all of that is true. But the social skill part is lacking. But why is that important? And so I always want to remind them, well, when they get to middle school age and all their peers' social skills have, you know, elevated, and they're still talking about Curious George, right? Those, or when their peers are getting jobs and ready for the workforce and they can't carry on a two-turn conversation. That's yeah. when we talk about that bridging that gap with early intervention early on to kind of help reinforce and build those skills that they, you know, are going to develop a lot more slowly. And the social isolation is still real, but in the Hmong community, we don't have a focus or even it's not important because we all are very socially isolated anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's so normal, y'all. And it's just like the idea of having that community, it's okay. So then our individuals with autism, they're going to inevitably be socially isolated, but it's so acceptable for that social isolation to happen anyway. So it's like, why do we need to worry about social isolation? It's not a concern, but it's like, it is, because and as you probably heard on some of the episodes, we talk about we don't know what's gonna happen. Who's gonna care for your child, love your child? How are they gonna do if they don't have those social skills to advocate for themselves, to share, what helps them to live that fulfilling life? If we were kind of just okay with the social isolation all these years, it is very important. And so it all impacts every chapter of their life, leading into old age. But I wonder if within the Hmong community, because there isn't such an emphasis or of importance on socialization, I think even my husband and I, we kind of joke that we're on an island of our own, around here, right? But we don't, we're here kind of on an island, and that's so socially acceptable. And so, I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are on that.
I think you bring up a great point, and I think that's why autism diagnosis gets missed in the Hmong community for higher functioning folks, because in the collective community, like the Hmong community, these social interactions look different.
Yes.
We don't engage in the etiquette of social interactions. I'm not saying, how are you? How's life with you? Oh, so we don't, sometimes we don't even talk. Like, it's just random. And you can come in and you don't even have to talk. You could just kind of sit with them and maybe do things with them. And because there's this unconditional love and acceptance, that there are no social expectations to engage in a pro-social manner.
Yes.
Right? Unless you're just clearly non-social, clearly awkward, you kind of get missed, and there's no expectations of that. Mm-hmm. And even when some folks are a little bit awkward socially, it's just,
yes.
So it's an acceptance of that person. And so within the collective community, there is no need to develop social skills, because you're unconditionally loved and accepted.
Yes.
Whereas now, community, we're all living apart. So when you're going to school, maybe your cousin doesn't want to hang out with you, because you're not like in the Hmong way where we're cousins, we hang out. I mean, back in the days, that's what we did growing up. But now cousins don't hang out with each other. Now they're choosing to hang out with friends that they have more common interests with. Mm-hmm. You might have a cousin that you care for, but you're not choosing to hang out with them because they're socially awkward. Right?
Right.
And back in the days, think about this. Back in the days, socially awkward. Nah? Mm-hmm. Maybe they're showing signs of high functioning autism, where they have interests that are very unusual. They don't know how to engage in that reciprocal social interaction. Guess what? So because most of the time, show the traits of autism. Studies have shown that it tends to be more males that are diagnosed with that. And so the quality of personal experience, and so because it's a patriarchal culture, when a male cannot engage in the dating scene because they don't have these skills to do that, and they're also very fixed in their interest, and that's what I think has traditionally happened. And I think that the lower functioning autistic kids are the ones that get diagnosed and identified, and it's a lot easier to diagnose them and identify them because not only do they have struggles in the social communication interaction area and also the repetitive behaviors or interests, but they also have deficits in the language, in the cognitive, and in their overall mannerisms, where they're probably like flapping their hands, and they obviously look very, very delayed.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the ones that I think tend to be more identified and getting services earlier on than the higher functioning ones.
Yes, for sure. You know, I was born in a refugee camp, right? So I don't know what life was like in Laos and what the conversations at the time, you know, pre-80s was like. But I would say, yeah, you know, you're a little tan now. Regardless of how aware or not aware they are of mental disabilities, developmental intellectual disabilities, sometimes they go hide there, y'all, but they in your bed, go they can't be supported only. They not be supported only. And as a young child, you would be like, oh my gosh, it must be the United States, y'all, you know, or especially when they talk about like things like diagnosis like cancer. But they bring up the care, you want more cancer, thought they can make that, don't know, cold the night, but shut up, you know, we go more cancer, you know. And it's like, well, you think about that. And then, you know, for me coming into the field, I go, you know, that can't be accurate. That cannot. It can't be that, oh, once the Hmong, you know, came to America, then all of these, you know, all of these diagnoses just popped up out of nowhere. So I do feel like it's a overgeneralized misunderstanding of disability. And so it's just that overgeneralized term too, dua, you know, it's it's just, and you know, on my podcast, I that's the one soapbox I will stand on at all times and just say, can we move away from that and find a different term, you know, or just not use that term for disability? Because I think when you, for parents, young ones, even mid-age, older ones, when you, because we talk about labeling, y'all, when others and yourself label you to me, or this is Dorana, it does something. You kind of, maybe it sets different expectations, and like you said, all the hopes and dreams that you had, they kind of diminished a little bit, because you know, you put that word, because you bought the lalu duana constitute a certain understanding. Everybody understands what it means, but it's like, but then it's hard, because with autism, no, they're so smart. He can do a 100-piece puzzle at 3, at 2. They can tell you all the presidents. They can tell you all these things. So it's not the correct terminology. And so I will always die on that mountain by myself. But yeah, can you speak to, you know, when yellow we never seen this before. This is must be a new condition, a new diagnosis. I don't know what happened. And it's like, no, I think it existed. We just didn't have a term for it, right? We go back to terminology again. That understanding, awareness, education, someone from the city to come up and say, hey guys, it's okay. Here, there's a term, there's a thing, you know, but, you know, I'm grateful that we are advanced enough now to acknowledge that and, you know, like an early intervention. But yeah, can you shed some light on that?
Well, I think, I mean, that is a really important thing to cover, right? Because we don't want to send the message that our culture was free of symptoms and free of conditions. It's how we have conceptualized these symptoms,
yes,
and how we have addressed or not addressed these symptoms,
correct,
that has masked the conditions.
Absolutely.
So what I mean by that is that our collective practices of Shipa, Shihlu, our collective practices have often masked the nuanced challenges of the individuals because we're not an individualized society. So yakama ituminyo wanu show some of these symptoms that are not in the severe range, but in the moderate to the mild range, then as a collective, and so going back to what we said earlier, you know, the there's the unconditional acceptance that you don't have to talk. Kind of mask that. We do everything for you, you know. You come in and you don't have to speak and there's no expectations, and therefore it doesn't get identified. You know, then the ones that are more on the more severe end of the spectrum, right, they're fully cared for by the collective. And so they're either sheltered, coddled, or ostracized. And so you never know that that other family has someone that's struggling with more severe autistic symptoms. And then when they come out, it's like, and so they unfortunately, they get ostracized in that way. And no one really knows about them. And as a kid, you kind of vaguely remember that family member, but they weren't really part of the family. And so So you're just not, your radar is just not high up on in terms of the percentages, right? And you and I are both not researchers, so a lot of this is anecdotal information. Yes. But that's where it has to start, because we have both, you know, agreed that this is more seminal than anything because we talk about it. And yet we don't have the data, but we have the human experience, the life experience to say, we know of people that are delayed, whether they're autistic or not, we don't know because and yet they may be on the autism spectrum, but the collective practices have either sheltered them or masked those delays, those struggles, to where they seem to be doing well, they seem to be functional in the community. And part of it is because we don't prioritize social skills as much in our home community. If they don't want to talk, it's okay. As long as the, you know, even if they don't have language, I don't know if that's as big of a concern in our community.
Right.
As long as they can understand what is expected of them, as long as they can fulfill the roles that we ask of them. And even if they can fulfill it not 100% well, as long as they can fulfill it well enough, then kind of let it be. So I think that's why they get hidden in all of these pockets of the collective practices.
Yes, that's such a great perspective. You know, I never considered that way. And thank you so much for pointing out too that we're not researchers, you know, but I hope that anyone who's listening today, maybe you or your child, you know, we see a lot of siblings, you know, who are inspired. You guys want to go and become a researcher? We hope this propels you there. We, you know, encourage you. You know, Dr. Listen, I was just talking about I'm in my 40s and I'm pretty settled with, you know, where I want to continue the rest of my career. But I think we need the data, you know, and I'm excited for the future. I'm here to uplift the future Hmong researchers who will give us the data to say, hey, here is where we're at. Here's the baseline, right? But I'm just so happy to get this conversation started. That's been the whole point of this podcast, is normalizing these conversations. And today, to hear and that's partially too why I invited you on the show, is that I know a lot of people who listen are probably 20-30 range, but someone that they feel like they're at a Hmong outing, it's so comforting, even though it's overwhelming. It's just so comforting because, you know, that's what you grew up with. And so thank you for bringing your voice and your experience and insight to my little podcast here. Is I've learned so much today, and you've given me so much food for thought and so much of your experience. And thank you so much for, you know, what you've contributed to the Hmong community up there in the Twin Cities. And I just am excited to see where this goes. And I'm excited to have you as an ally, as a partner in this conversation. You know, it was a little nerve-wracking to see if the Hmong community was ready for this conversation, and to have all of you guys just really support it and be so encouraging. It has done amazing things for me. So wachawa, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much, Tia, for this opportunity to engage around this really important conversation with autism and with developmental delays, and with just shedding a light on the importance of being open for prevention or early intervention, mm-hmm. right? Because I think that's what you're really yes. trying to do here, is not only raising awareness, but that this raising of awareness will open that door to those early interventions, so yes. that the trajectory of a child who shows these symptoms mm-hmm. will get the resources and the service early enough
yes.
so that they don't have to suffer or struggle.
Mm-hmm.
As a teen, as a young adult, when we don't want to get to that stage. We want them to get that early intervention services so that they can live a life that is interactive and engaging and full to their, you know, to their abilities. So thank you for this opportunity to have this conversation. Thank you for the work that you do, the passion that you pour into it. I can see that you are very passionate about this, and it has been my pleasure to have this conversation with you. So
thank you so much. I look forward to working with you in the future and continuing to bring tough conversations like this. You know, I think that it is time to have them, and to let yeah. the families out there know that you're not alone, and there are individuals out there willing to help you get these conversations started. So, Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.